Proceedings. Each week, I ask a question of the community and the folks in the room, how are the children? And the reason that I ask that is that I know that when our children are taken care of with a good education, a roof over their heads, a meal in their stomach, and caring adults in their lives, that they have a much higher chance of succeeding and becoming successful in life. And so each week, we invite folks in to talk to us. And this morning, we have Angel Collazo and Cindy Lopez. They're both 10th graders at Roosevelt High School. If you could please come forward. Thank you for being here. And when you speak, if you just state your name. Either one can start.
I'm Angel. I'm a sophomore at Roosevelt High School. And I would like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to give my point of view on renaming Interstate Avenue.
Okay.
I also would like to thank you for giving us the opportunity for giving our point of view, Cindy Lopez also. Thank you very much.
Okay.
So I'll give my speech first.
Please.
So before Cesar E. Chavez, farm workers were becoming sick because of pesticides being used on crops. When Cesar Chavez co-founded the National Farm Workers Association, he stood up for the farmers' rights, leading boycotts to bring attention to health problems. Being able to change Interstate Avenue to Cesar E. Chavez Boulevard would be a fantastic way of showing gratitude for a great activist who didn't just work here in Oregon but had a college named after him in Mount Angel, Oregon. He visited the college twice to support it in its needs. This college was the first four-year Mexican-American college in the United States. He also won the Peace on Earth Award given to him in 1992. I acknowledge that it will cost a lot of money to rename the street, $100,000 about, but does remembering not just a someone, but an amazing activist who cared for people's rights have a price? He really isn't recognized here in the Northwest. Naming a street after him will be a fantastic way to recognize his accomplishments here. Caring for education, fighting for rights, and all that work for what you say, for better lives for the next generation. So I say that renaming Interstate Avenue Cesar E. Chavez would be the least we could do to be grateful for this man's accomplishments. Thank you.
Thank you, Angel.
I will start my speech now. And contributions to labor workers by Chavez gave laborers the opportunity for better pay and equal treatments. In 1968, laborers in California were not at all receiving adequate pay. Cesar Chavez got involved with these workers, leading to the grape strike and also the grape boycott. This helped build the foundation of the National Farm Workers Association. Reason why Interstate Avenue should be renamed to Cesar E. Chavez Boulevard, to add tribute to his life. Chavez was a labor organizer, spent time working and teaching, and few sites are actually named after him here in the Northwest. We should also honor him for his nonviolent activism and contribution. I understand that the expense will come onto small businesses on Interstate, but isn't the money worth giving a statement about or for the Latino community? I also understand that we could also name another street, but does any other street actually fall into the needs or the, what we need like on this street, like different ethnic groups in many different racial communities? Oh my gosh. Cesar Chavez worked hard in California and here in Oregon, as well as this is why he should be tributed with the renaming of Interstate Avenue.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you, folks, very much for coming in. And Sonny, thank you for bringing them. So let's give these young folks a hand for being civically engaged.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Council will come to order. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams?
Here.
Leonard?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Sten? Potter.
Here. I would like to remind folks that prior to offering public testimony to City Council, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity he or she is authorized to represent. Please read the first communication.
Item 1256, request of Sharon Nassett to address Council regarding Columbia River Crossing project transportation issues.
Could you read the name again, please?
She's here.
Oh, okay.
Just set it down front. Just set it down front. Okay. That's good. We can see it.
For the record, my name is Sharon Nassett. My address is 1113 North Baldwin. I have given Ms. Carla some packages today, which I know you will not be able to look at while we are discussing this, but I will be back in a couple of weeks to ask for a formal letter from you. As you know, we're currently involved in the Columbia River Crossing NEPA process. And the NEPA process is the National Environmental Policy Act. And why it's called a policy act and not a protection act, it's about how we go about deciding what we do. We take our projects, we turn them into apples, so they all look the same, and then we study them. It is in accordance with the law that when things are brought in, that they are accurately studied. It's a very high bar to get something accepted into and for consideration in a transportation project. The I-5 task force accepted the third bridge crossing near the railroad tracks. I know all of you gentlemen are aware of the railroad tracks west of I-5 and the fact that a new bridge in that corridor would take care of the truck traffic in and out of our ports, give direct freeway access to our industrial areas and support them, and take traffic out of our neighborhoods as well as developing a better for our economy. When this process started, the River Crossing 14 Bi-State Industrial Corridor was accepted into the current Columbia River Crossing because it met the high bar. It was removed from the crossing without being studied, without engineering, and without following the process that they said would be set forward. Your council here is one of the councils that will be signing off on this. What I am asking for today are two things. One is for you to stand up and go with the law, which is to study all viable options. And there is no harm in studying something, whether you like it or not. Doesn't mean it's going to be accepted. It is the fair and honest way that the NEPA process was set up. You're going to be signing off on this, and I'm sure you would like it to be fair and honest. The second thing I'm going to be coming back for is the location of the study, which is inside the bridge influence area and inside the corridor. Right now, they have been refusing to follow through on studying it as was said that they would do when it was brought in. They also have not looked at the second part of the NEPA process, which is constructability, costs, neighborhood issues, and the economy. Those things must be looked at. They were promised to. I'm going to be asking you to declare where the boundaries are and that the process be open and follow as it should. Thank you.
Thank you. Please read the next.
1257, request of David Morrison to address council regarding aerosol operations over Portland.
Thanks for being here. Please state your name when you speak, and you have 3 minutes.
David Morrison, and I'm very happy that you asked how the children are, because none of us will be in very good shape if these programs continue. I'm here to address an issue of public safety and the survival of our ecosystems. There are over 60 acknowledged weather modification programs that are currently in place. On almost any day, we can look up in the sky and see persistent contrails. and the airplanes that are applying various aerosol formulas to the air we breathe. These contrails contain aluminum, barium, and other heavy metals, as well as various biological elements. The Weather Mitigation Research and Development Policy Authorization Act of 2007 are moving forward in committees on commerce, science, and transportation. These bills were not referred to committees on agriculture, natural resources, the EPA, forestry, and there was no invitation to debate. I'll get to where this, you know, concerns this council, and it's not just a national issue. There will be no members of the public to be appointed to the board, no EPA reps, no natural resources or forestry representatives, and no provisions for public or agricultural oversight of these programs. In other words, it's a stealth program that has been in operation, and they're now trying to legalize it with this bill. Since the late 90s, these programs have been stepped up, and NASA, in their October 2005 newsletter, acknowledged that increasingly persistent contrails forming man-made clouds trap warmth in the atmosphere and are exacerbating global warming. They note the long-term effects in the Earth's climate as well as its natural resources as a result of these programs. As various health problems, including asthma, Alzheimer's, and autoimmune diseases skyrocket, so does a growing worldwide outcry against this heinous assault on our bodies and the environment via the air we breathe. Two cities, Berkeley, California, and I believe it's Aegina, Greece, have taken action to declare the space above all citizens a space-based weapons-free zone supported by a bill introduced by Dennis Kucinich in 2003 that would ban these programs. The citizens of Aegina have begun legal action to stop the spraying above their island. Berkeley Council member Donna Spring expressed her gratitude to Kucinich and said, "This resolution of the Council of the City of Berkeley is recommended to be adopted by all municipalities in the United States and worldwide." So that's what I'm proposing here, that you take it up as an issue and make our voice heard. At the end of the packet that I'm passing out, there are hard copies of soil tests that were done on the Oregon coast that will startle even the most stoic observer. There are thousands and thousands of times the accepted amount of aluminum in the soil of the Oregon coast and Northern California. I'm calling on the City Council to address this issue of public safety and be an example so that we can stop this hideous practice and help heal the planet for ourselves and especially our children. And I just want to show people some pictures here of that were taken all in Portland. Some examples. So I hope you guys take this seriously. Thank you.
Read the next.
1258, request of Joe Johns to address council regarding environment, pollution, and storm drains.
Before I address the council, I just wanted to say to Sam Adams, I'm supposed to deliver a check to you for $500, and this check is for made out to the Portland Department of Transportation. We have agreed to do a partnership with them to put two stop signs by the Selwood Community Center in St. Agatha School.
That's part of your time.
Huh?
That's part of your time, so.
Okay.
Joe, go ahead and introduce yourself by name, and you have 3 minutes.
Yes, I'll do that. My name is Joe Johns. I live at 1806 Southeast St. Andrews Drive in Selwyn. We are here to address the following bureaus: the Neighborhood Involvement, Transportation, and BES, Sustainable Development, the Water Bureau, and the proposal that's in front of you will show you that to be adopted by the commissioners for those bureaus as working prototype as soon as possible. We promised the BES, Lynn Main, that we would bring a proposal that would help solve some of the city's and metro area contamination pollution concerns. One of the biggest pollution concerns is charity car wash fundraisers held at parking lots. This wastewater from the source contains tox, hydro, carbon, and compounds which directly go into storm drains and then into the Willamette River. This wonderful contamination kills the fish and other fish and species in the 13th largest by volume river in the United States. The Willamette River in 2006 was listed as American third most endangered river in the country. The cities, counties, and the state government know that the car wash of fundraisers is a favorite for sports, schools, and other nonprofit organizations. So the state has refused to consider this type of pollution as a commercial pollution source. We know that the city of Portland can supersede the state of Oregon in adopting a no more charity car wash held in streets or parking lots. 1 gallon of oil contaminates 1 million gallons of water. This proposal has been prepared with joint effort between the business community and BES, the Water Pollution Control Laboratory. We have worked closely with Kelly Hendricks and Brett Hallstrom from BES. A special program has been set up to help fundraiser groups to raise money by washing without polluting the rivers or streams. The Metro Charity Car Wash Incorporated has been set up to help these groups. The MC will purchase the tickets, and all the participating car washes will participate and help the without, and you'll be able to read that more in Chapter 4. Also, all the professional car washes, waste goes into a reclaim process and is recycled. You can read that on illustration on Chapter Number 5. This is a win-win situation. We'll be able to protect the environment, no pollution going into the storm drains. The salmon and steelhead and the Willamette River will be very, very happy. The other program that will help stop the pollution is the formation of the economic business, or the eco business by the BES. Okay. The last is, there's one what you mentioned. Remember, we did not inherit this land from our parents. We're borrowing it from our children. They would like it back in better shape than you received it. Any questions?
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
And thanks for the contribution to help pay for the stop signs.
Thank you.
That's all the communications.
Okay, move to the consent agenda. Do any of the commissioners wish to pull any items from the consent agenda? Please call the vote.
Item 1273, Commissioner Sten's office wanted to refer that back to his office.
Item 1273?
Yes.
Okay. Hearing no objection, so moved. Go ahead. Please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye.
Please read the 9:30 time certain.
Item 1259, declared city support of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities.
Mr. Kantos, could you please come forward? Mr. Kantos has come to Portland through our disability program and will be the keynote speaker at an awards luncheon today. And later this week, the Disability Chamber of Commerce, the first in the nation, which started here in Portland, will celebrate their second year. Their men and women are creating their own businesses and excelling. So, Jan, I notice you don't look like Mr. Contos.
No, we're going to do first the resolution, and then Mr. Contos is going to come and speak about the employment.
Okay.
It's the area that he'll be speaking on today. So, good morning, Mayor and City Commissioners, or Council members. As chair of the Portland Citizens Disability Advisory Committee, which we call PCDAC, we are bringing to you two very important issues affecting persons with disabilities, not only in the Portland area, but worldwide. And the first thing that I would like to do is, it's UN Day, and over the last year, there has been a lot of attention on a UN convention that supports disability human rights globally. Our resolution is to you simply states that we, the City of Portland, support the efforts being made by the UN Convention to promote and secure universal human rights and access for people with disabilities. So before I read this resolution, I would like to invite some of the executive committee up here with me, and Michael Levine, who is vice chair of the committee, as well as David.
Morning.
Morning.
Whereas historically persons with disabilities have been marginalized and deprived of opportunities and of freedoms afforded to individuals without disabilities, and whereas on December 13, 2006, the United Nations General Assembly adopted by consensus a landmark treaty, the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, to promote and protect the rights of the world's 650 million individuals with disabilities. And whereas the convention is the first worldwide human rights treaty of the 21st century, and whereas the convention recognizes that attitudes need to change if individuals with disabilities are to achieve equality, and whereas the convention will require ratifying nations to promote, protect, and ensure the full and equal enjoyment of all human rights and fundamental freedoms by all persons with disabilities, and to promote respect for their inherent dignity and promote awareness of the capabilities of those who are disabled, and whereas the convention also requires government to fight stereotypes about people with disabilities, and whereas the convention also recognizes that perspectives need to change if individuals with disabilities are to achieve equality, and whereas the City of Portland complies with the regulations of governments under Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, and whereas in the 2000 census, 68,757 city residents between the ages of 5 and 64 reported a disability, 13% of the city's total population. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the City Council of the City of Portland, Oregon, that it supports this convention, endorses equality opportunity, and will continue to be responsive to and inclusive of people with disabilities. Be it further resolved that the city would communicate the city's support of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities to United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and the acting U.S. Representative of the United Nations, Alejandro DeWolf, and urge ratification of the convention by the United States. So that's one part of our agenda, and thank you, both of you. The other part is, as you know, this is Disability Employment Awareness Month, and we would like to bring awareness to this issue by introducing our special guest, Ollie Contos from the Department of Justice, to speak with this issue. And Ollie, would you mind coming up and sitting next to me? There you go. He will also, as you said, Mayor Potter, that he will be our keynote speaker at the Disability Awards happening later today. And I would like to read a little about Ollie. He's actually become quite a good friend of mine. We met several years ago, and his knowledge, he just is wonderful. But let me read a little bit. Blind since birth, Ollie Contos is special counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights in the U.S. Department of Justice, originally commissioned by Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez in March 2006. Mr. Contos recently returned to this post after having served two consecutive terms of service as Associate Director for Domestic Policy at the White House, where he led the implementation of the President's New Freedom Initiative, the agenda for advancing equality of opportunity for people with all types of disabilities in information and assistive technology, education, employment, and every aspect of community living. One of the highest placed persons with a disability in the federal government today, Mr. Contos is member of the Attorney General's Committee for the Employment of People with Disabilities, member of the Incident Management Team of the Interagency Coordinating Council on Emergency Preparedness, and Individuals with Disabilities headed by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, to name a few, and in these and other prominent roles. His responsibilities include fostering closer ties between the Justice Department and disability rights leaders at all levels, facilitating greater compliance by businesses with applicable federal disability rights laws, and establishing and strengthening new cross-agency partnerships to promote full participation by people with disabilities in every facet of life. And so I'd like to introduce you to my friend Ole.
Mr. Mayor and distinguished members of the City Council, good morning. I am pleased to get to be here today and bring you greetings on behalf of Rena J. Comisak, Acting Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the United States Department of Justice. I am particularly pleased to be here to serve in a speaking role with various efforts that are taking place here in Portland regarding promotion of rights and responsibilities of individuals with all types of disabilities, and I am particularly honored today to be here in your presence. When we look at this country, the census figures also reveal that there are more than 54 million Americans with disabilities in this country. These include individuals with visible disabilities, such as mine and others who use wheelchairs, crutches, and other mobility devices. And there are those with invisible disabilities, such as psychiatric disabilities, learning disabilities, epilepsy, diabetes, and so forth. And when looking at the totality of the population of individuals with disabilities who are in this country, as varied as we are, we also see how there is no such thing as looking at an individual and determining whether or not that individual has a disability, because 90% of all disabilities are not necessarily visible. So for those individuals who may have a disability that is not visible, what may actually end up happening is the reaction to that individual, if a disability is revealed, is to say, gosh, you don't look disabled. But the reality is that as diverse as our community is in general, the same is true for people with disabilities. And our talents and abilities collectively as a disability community are just as wide and varied as everyone else. And to be direct, we are just as lazy or ambitious as everybody else. We are just as mean or nice as everybody else. We are just as anything as everybody else. However, there is one area in which we are not like everyone else, and that is our employment figures. According to the most recent data, the employment rate among individuals with disabilities is 38.1%. And that is a figure that is unacceptably low. We must continue to work to advance employment opportunities for people with disabilities at every job, ranging from cleaning the office to running it. We need to continue to make sure to understand the reality of the physical, programmatic, and attitudinal barriers that continue to exist in society that bar full participation of people with all types of disabilities. And where does Portland fall within all of this? The answer is actually relatively simple. We each have an obligation and a responsibility to do whatever we can to maximize inclusion of people with disabilities in every aspect of community life. And from what I understand, the city of Portland has 23 different individuals designated as ADA coordinators within various departments and other components. We at the United States Department of Justice are supportive of the disability community here in the city in its efforts to push for a central ADA coordinator in order to coordinate these various individuals with their various rights and responsibilities and to help ensure compliance with Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which provides that any entity receiving federal funding must not discriminate against people with disabilities. And you are to be commended for your leadership thus far in the things that you have done to advance opportunities and access for people with all types of disabilities. And as all of you continue to exercise that leadership, by bringing together individuals through a central ADA coordinator while reaching out to people representing those with physical, psychiatric, developmental, and learning disabilities, then Portland may continue to strive to be a model for other cities to follow all across this country. And as this effort continues, so will efforts take place within every aspect of the disability community, as well as those who work alongside members of the disability community to advocate for equal rights and equal responsibilities. The resolution that has been proposed rightfully points out how 13% of those who are in the city are self-identified as individuals with disabilities. That therefore means that more than 68,000 individuals have an opportunity to be touched by your leadership as you continue to serve as an example for others to follow, and as you work meaningfully to put into place the appropriate policies, practices, programs, procedures, and activities that maximize full inclusion, not only of children with disabilities, but also of adults with disabilities. When thinking about our own respective roles, we also stop for a moment to recognize how, in light of the number of people with disabilities that are in this country today, it is a fact that each and every one of us either has a disability or knows somebody who has a disability, even though that disability may or may not be self-identified, considering that one in every six individuals in this country has a disability. And so when looking at this reality, we also see an amazing opportunity for continued partnership. I, sitting here on behalf of Acting Assistant Attorney General Rena J. Comisak, wish to reach out to this city and its leaders at all levels in partnership by urging you to continue to do whatever you can to serve the disability community and to comply with appropriate federal laws that pertain to equality of opportunity and access for people with disabilities. And as you do that, I also would like to provide information to you regarding where you may go for further resources. Within the context of employment, you may go to www.eeoc.gov and www.opm.gov. And for other information, the Office of Disability Employment Policy of the United States Department of Labor, www.dol.gov/ODEP. And centralized information about civil rights of people with disabilities, as well as obligations of including cities and towns, you may go to www.ada.gov. And my direct contact information is olie.cantos, C-A-N as in Nancy, T as in Tom, O-S, at usdoj.gov. And my number is 202-514-8191. And so in looking ahead regarding what the next steps will be, we at the Department of Justice look forward to working in partnership with you to help ensure that there is appropriate access for people with all types of disabilities. And as the city works to continue to do the right thing, we at the department will be behind this effort 100%. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Contos. I had a question for you. I'm very proud of our Disability Chamber of Commerce. Are there other chambers like this in the United States?
Matter of fact, as far as I know, there is not. The general philosophy of the disability community is to create entities that are actually more integral to general society. So in other words, as part of the philosophy of integration within, let's say, a chamber context, it's important for various people who are owners who have disabilities to integrate themselves into every aspect of the existing Chamber of Commerce. At the same time, they themselves, as they work hard the way they would in any organization, may rise in leadership as others without disabilities would rise in leadership. And then as that continues to build, then there will be a broader focus on integration of people with disabilities within the business community. And the other interesting thing to note is that according to the Small Business Administration, there are more than 30,000 business owners with disabilities in this country, www.sba.gov. And in light of what's happening here with the local Disability Chamber of Commerce, I would look forward to the opportunity to working in collaboration with them to see how it is that we may promote areas of mutual interest.
Thank you, Mr. Contos. Thank you, Jan.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for supporting the resolution as well as recognizing that this is the Awareness Month for Employment for People with Disabilities.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And welcome to Portland, Mr. Contos.
Thank you, sir. I'm pleased to be here.
Thank you. Are there folks who are signed up to testify?
We have one person signed up, Teresa Teeter.
Please state your name for the record, and you have 3 minutes.
Good morning. My name is Teresa Teeter, downtown Portland citizen activist. I just want to sit here and thank this council because over the years I've testified on many venues of disability, homelessness issues in downtown Portland area, and Commissioner Sten's not here this morning, I'm sorry, but I wanted to commend the council for having the public listening sessions with the disabled folks after the situation with James Chase Chassie, and that the police department and the mayor was kind enough to step up to ease and listen to folks' concerns regarding police interaction with disabled persons in this town, and as well as the accommodations for certain set-asides for apartments in, like, the Pearl District and condominium areas to merge folks with disabilities and other issues in life to fit in with other people that don't have disabilities. And so I just wanted to state that this morning, that you guys have really taken quite an effort in the last couple of years to do these things, and it's very important that people know, because not everybody listens every week, and some people feel like they're left between the cracks, but the cracks are being sealed. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Teresa.
That's all who signed up.
Okay. Please call a vote on this resolution.
Adams?
Well, I just want to welcome you to the city of Portland, and I want to thank our local advocacy community for all your ongoing excellent work. We're very lucky to be able to partner with such a wonderful group of hardworking, passionate advocates. Aye.
Leonard?
And I echo those comments. Thank you very much. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I want to thank Mr. Contos for being here in Portland, and great testimony. I want to thank Jan and Michael and all the leaders in our community for your steadfast work, and I think this resolution is very important, and I am pleased to support it. Aye.
Potter.
I'd like to echo the rest of the city council and welcome you to Portland, Mr. Contos, and also I hope that I'm able to get up to the Forestry Center for your speech today, but in either case, we hope that that our local community and the federal government and the city of Portland can work hand in hand to make life better for all of our community, including people with disabilities. So thank you, sir, and I vote aye. Thank you.
Thank you. We're rushing off to the lunch.
Please read the 10 a.m. time certain.
Item 1260, Willamette River Combined Sewer Overflow Program Update.
Commissioner Adams.
Well, I'm pleased today to introduce the leaders in the Bureau of Environmental Services, Dean Merritt and Paul Gribben, who have been with me working hard to make sure that the Combined Sewer Overflow Program is on time and on budget, which it is. But we're going to give you some more details today and have an opportunity for you to ask questions. Mr. Merritt.
Thank you very much, Mayor, members of the Council. I'm Dean Merritt, Director of Environmental Services. With me is Paul Gribben, engineer in charge of both the west side and the east side tunnel projects. We have been before you basically every 6 months for the last several years. I was joking with Paul earlier that I'm sure you're looking forward to the day when we come in with a sign saying the end is near. And
light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah. We're going to just give you a quick update today. My purpose is to lead off, and then Paul will pick up with details about the East Side project. Just to refresh your recollection, this is a 20-year program, began in 1991, and we have made a lot of progress in the interim, including the completion of the work on the Columbia Slough in 2001, the completion of the West Side Big Pipe project in 2006, and the beginning of the work on the Willamette River East Side CSO controls. Our target date is for completion is December of 2011. Now, people ask all the time how we stack up against other major communities that also have combined sewer overflow problems. As you can see, we're generally can be described as ahead of the curve. We will be finished long before many of the major cities in the country are finished, and our cost projections are shown for you there, about $1.4 billion. Other communities like Atlanta will top $2 billion. Washington, D.C. will probably come in about $2 billion. So there will be some advantage to us getting finished before they are finished. Just a few significant signals here. The Cornerstone projects, where we engage people and citizens and businesses to reduce the amount of stormwater entering the sewer system, is we're very, very successfully completing that project. The Columbia Slough projects, as I mentioned, are finished. The West Side Tunnel is finished. The East Side Big Pipe project is underway. The famous ski slope diagram here to show you how much progress we've made. When we began in 1990, 1991, we estimated that we were discharging about 6 billion gallons of combined sewage and stormwater annually to the Willamette and to the Columbia Slough. If you follow that ski slope down to the right, you can see that we're now down in the 2 billion gallon range, so we're two-thirds of the way to the finish line, and the East Side Big Pipe project will take us across that finish line. Countdown as far as the number of outfalls are concerned, the 13 outfalls into the Columbia Slough are now controlled. We had to finish 7 Willamette River outfalls by December of 2001. Those are also finished. We had 16 Willamette River outfalls to control by December of 2006. We are on schedule. Those are controlled. The final 19 CSO outfalls are slated to be controlled as part of the East Side project by December of 2011. Now, a lot of our success has involved, as many of you have done, involving citizens in helping us solve this problem. Our biggest notable success is the Downspout Disconnection Program. We have been engaged with citizens for almost a decade now in doing this. Citizens can do the work themselves, and we pay them $53 a downspout, or if they want a community group or a nonprofit to do that for them, and we pay the nonprofit or community group to do that work. The results have been nothing short of amazing. It's probably the most cost-effective method we have discovered yet for controlling stormwater. As of July this year, over 50,000 downspouts have been disconnected from our sewer system at 25,000 homes. This has kept, we estimate, 1.2 billion gallons of CSO out of the Willamette and the Columbia Slough. So it is by far the most cost-effective approach that we have come upon. Paul will talk to you about how things are going with the East Side Big Pipe.
I'm Paul Gribben. I oversee the tunnel program for BES. Just very briefly, just to give you an idea of the magnitude of the project, as we talked about before, it's a 6-mile-long tunnel, 22 feet in diameter. It's about 120 feet underneath the ground along the east side of the river, and it extends all the way from southeast 17th and McLaughlin to Swan Island. Here's the current status. Right now, the tunnel boring machine itself is almost 2,000 feet north of the upper shaft. It's almost halfway to the first, the second shaft north, which would be Alder. 2 months were lost initially on the breakout of the machine from the shaft. There was a leak in the wall of the upper shaft during the breakout, and once that leak got repaired, they had a number of glitches. As a brand new machine, there were a number of electrical mechanical problems with the launch. We lost about 2 months off of the contractor's initial schedule. A recovery schedule was put together that added 6- and 7-day work weeks to the schedule to make up most of the time by the time the machine got to Alder Shaft. Since that time, a different problem has arisen in the opposite direction. The machine has taken off much faster than we had ever anticipated. We were figuring an average of 35 feet a day between Opera and Alder Shaft. Its record now is 95 feet in 1 day. It looks like it's averaging about 55 feet or more. So we expect that by the time the machine reaches Alder, all that schedule will have been made up. So now it's a matter of keeping the tunnel segments produced fast enough to keep up with the machine, but it has exceeded all our expectations so far. This just gives you an idea. If you look at the lower piece on the plan view, the upper shaft is on your left, which is just a little bit south of OMSI, and you can see that the machine is about halfway to the Alder Shaft, which is at the location of the original Cornos building, which is right across the street from River City Bikes. So it's about 2,000 feet. We're going 7 days a week now to get underneath the Hawthorne Bridge, and then it'll go back to six-day-week schedule. And once it reaches the Morrison Bridge, it goes 7 days a week again. We don't want to stop the machine under the bridges. But so far, ground settlement has been insignificant, and as I said, the machine is going much faster than anyone anticipated. This, just to give you an idea about how we manage risks, and the review committee actually suggested that we include this, and I thought it was a really good idea. But before we did anything, we went over every risk we were taking and everything that could possibly go wrong. And we meet with the contractor quarterly and a designer to go and review all the project risks. And as we pass one and it's now gone, we cross it off the list. If there are new risks that we think are coming up, we add them. And we assign the original contingency dollars to the risk if they actually occurred, such that the loss in time with the original breakout from the shaft, upper shaft, although we didn't plan it, we anticipated that it might happen. And so we had set aside contingency to cover it. So as we go forward, as we go past the places where the risks occur, we hope to cross the risks off and adjust our contingency dollars down as we go. So risk management is a continual process, and it will continue through the life of the contract. This is where we are as far as cost is concerned. That dashed blue line atop is the original cash flow curve. Before any work was done, that's how we anticipated that we would spend money, and this is cumulative over time. The green line is how the money has actually been spent. And then the orange line is a projection of how we think we're going to spend it. So right now we're underspent because some of the initial work that was off the critical path has been spread out a little bit longer than we had, the contractor had originally planned. But it just means that costs are spread out a little bit more over time. But we're not anticipating at this point any excess expenditures. Right now we're projecting to come in a little bit under the original contract amount. As far as minority women, emerging small businesses, and local business participation, the first 19 months of the contract, we have 159 local subcontracts have been awarded. 132 of those have been with minority women and emerging small businesses. That's a contract value of about $19 million. And other local subcontracts have been in about $11 million. So the goal on this was $26 million. We anticipate a lull in the middle of the contract because that's where we're doing most of the mining. But once we get towards the end of the contract, we anticipate a lot more local participation as a lot of the cleanup work, paving, landscaping, all that sort of stuff starts to come back into play. So right now it looks like we're on track to exceed what our original goal was. Challenges coming up. We have to cross underneath the Burnside Bridge, make a turn, another turn, and get through Sullivan's Gulch underneath the Banfield Interchange. It's been well planned. Right now, we don't anticipate any problems, but it's one of the challenges we have facing us. The Sullivan's Gulch, the geology is sands and silt, so it's just a very careful procedure through there. And then the rest of the work in the Central East Side industrial area, there's a lot of pipeline work. It's ongoing now, and it's always our goal is to keep all the businesses in operation, access to all the loading docks, get traffic through there, and make sure all the businesses stay open. So just from a public involvement standpoint, our focus right now is in the Central East Side. So we have continual personal contact with individual businesses, and maintaining business operations is a major effort on our part right now. Traffic notifications and interpretive signs so everybody knows what's going on, where we're going to be.
And let me just follow up on that because Commissioner Adams knows this from having attended some of these meetings of the Businesses for Clean Rivers. We meet with the business community from the Central East Side on a regular basis. Our staff is out almost every day meeting with people, making sure they have access to their loading dock, their employees have access to their business, and their customers do too. But periodically, we get them all together in a room so that they can share their experience, and if there are any common themes, we can address those. And we've been fortunate that we've established, I think, a very good working relationship with the impacted businesses. And I just want to take another moment to thank them. You all are familiar every day with the construction impact from the work on the transit mall, and you have experienced personally those inconveniences. These folks have experienced this plus more. They've had huge cranes and excavators, some of them parked in front of their business, and their customers find it difficult to find them from time to time, and we really do appreciate their efforts to help us clean up the Willamette River. On the Community Benefit Opportunity Program, I know many of you are aware of this. We did this with the West Side Program. We set aside some money. We put a citizens committee together. We want to make sure that the neighborhoods are better in better shape than when we arrived. We've done the same for the East Side. That citizens committee has finished their report and recommendation for how to invest in community improvements. We will be bringing those to you next month to report on some civic improvements that we will fund and that they will help implement, again, so that by the time we finish and move on, those improvements have already been made, and again, the business community or the neighborhoods are in better shape than before we arrived. So you'll get that report next month. And just a final word, I know some of you had the chance to go into the West Side Tunnel during construction. We're going to have another opportunity this time to go into the East Side Tunnel, and you'll be able to see just how much bigger this one is than the West Side was. We're shooting for around the end of the calendar year, late December, early January. When we reach the Alder Shaft, there will be a time period when the contractor is doing some maintenance work. That would be a good opportunity to have an open house or an open tunnel. And we will, of course, invite all of you and hope that you can make that visit. Before we get to your questions, I just want to tell you that following us briefly, we do have an East Side CSO review committee, and Bill Martinak is here. He would like to address the council, say a few words on their behalf. But before Bill comes up, if you want to ask either Paul or I any questions, be happy to respond to those.
I had two questions. One is, how deep is the tunnel on the east side?
It averages about 120 feet.
And so I was thinking when you got to the Banfield, is it going downhill? I assume it is, since it's using gravity, right?
That's correct.
So, but it does go completely underneath the Banfield and the exchange there?
Yes. Yes, but the spot that was picked was where we had the greatest amount of room. It's why there's an S-curve to get under there. Straight shot would have been easier, but we did a lot of investigation, geophysical investigation, about where the piles were for the Banfield, so this is the best shot through.
The second question dealt with the seismic engineering. What do you do to protect a tunnel that large if there's a significant earthquake here?
It's all part of the design. Actually, the tunnel is designed for earthquake loads. The west side was, too. It's actually, at the time of when earthquake hits, the pipeline will move. The only issue you worry about is whether it moves differentially. But in earthquakes, typically, it doesn't. It moves as a unit. But it's designed to be flexible, to be able to handle that.
Up to what grade earthquake do you
This think? Is zone 3. So it's designed for earthquakes that would be expected to be received in the Portland area in that particular geology. Geology plays in, too. Fortunately, most of the tunnel is in the Troutdale Formation, which is a very stiff cemented gravel. So earthquake does not have as much of an impact on that. And that sand silts is a little more of a problem.
Yeah. Liquefaction? Or?
In sand silts, typically what you expect. Troutdale, no.
Thank
you. I would like to say one more thing I forgot. The, with the machine moving as fast as it is, it's not purely due to the machine. A lot of the workers we have down there got experience on the west side, and they're actually doing a phenomenal job, and that's the learning curve has just been very quick, and that's really the main reason.
So have we found any interesting historical archaeological artifacts in any of the shafts yet? Or?
Is it true we found D.B. Cooper? I heard rumors.
No, we haven't. Not that I'm aware of. We haven't found anybody. Jimmy Hoffa is still missing, though, I think.
So. Nobody knows.
I don't think we have found any historical artifacts.
Well, I walked door to door to the businesses in the Central East Side that have been, heavily impacted by this project. I mean, there's just no way around it. When you're having to sink the kinds of vertical shafts that we've had to sink on this project, but us or them are, thrilled that this kind of disruption is going on in the Central East Side. But I will say, having gone door-to-door, that time and time and again, I got compliments for the good work that the team is doing to mitigate as much of the disruption as possible. And I just wanted the council to know that. A lot of effort has gone into that, heart and soul of frontline folks at BES, and thank you.
Thank you. So Bill Martinak will come up for just a moment. Thanks.
morning, Mr. Mayor and commissioners. I'm Bill Martinek. I'm the co-chairman of the East Side Sewer Tunnel Project Review Committee. I guess the easiest thing for me to say this morning after Paul and Dean were up is just whatever they said. I mean, they pretty well covered how the project is going, but I would like to take a few minutes just to let you know how our committee is proceeding. Our committee had was initially appointed by the council. We had initially we had 17 members. Right now we're down to between 7 and 10 faithful members that show up, and we're currently holding meetings on a bi-monthly schedule. We've held 14 different meetings to date. Our charge has been to at least meet quarterly, and we're exceeding that, and we have been monitoring the contractors' efforts to meet all of the criteria set out by the contract. We are providing a forum to have a discussion for all of the issues that that Paul mentioned today, and just to bring some insight into the project as it proceeds. Right now, again, as Paul mentioned, the activities are well underway. The engineers or the contractor did suffer a small setback and failure as the machine broke out of the upper shaft, and that did cause some delays. But as we discussed in our last meeting, the machine now is racing out of the shaft and is moving even much faster than had ever been anticipated. So it appears that will put the contractor back on schedule and possibly even ahead of schedule after the first of the year at the rate of progress that they're making now. So it's moving very well. We do discuss safety issues now. We've gone over in our last meeting where the safety record is, and it's been impressive. The contractor is about 25% of what the normal incident rate would be for the number of man hours that they've worked. So they have just had a phenomenal record there. They've addressed their safety issues quickly and have had, their last quarter, they had basically nothing happen that was recordable there. So that's a phenomenal record for the amount of man hours that they're spending and the type of project that they're working on with all the equipment and all the difficulties that are going on there. That's a phenomenal record for them to have. So they need to be commended by that. Quality control issues, we've discussed that, and they are constantly monitoring the quality control of the tunnel. Again, as Paul said, there's a little bit of a learning curve as the crews start putting the tunnel together, and they are meeting and exceeding the expectations there. Subcontract work, again, with Paul's slide, the general contractor is doing an exceptional job of awarding subcontracts to the various minority, emerging, and women-owned businesses, and they're doing a great job there, and the contractors are performing well, and they are very happy with the progress that they're making. And they're also meeting their goals. Their apprenticeship training goals are also being met, and they are they're doing well there also. The budget of the project, again, about $128 million has been spent to date. The spending is lagging a little bit from what the projected expenditures were, and I think Paul gave you a little graph there that just shows that they are spending just a little bit less than had been anticipated, but it's early on in the project, so but to date that sounds great. Basically, the partnership seems to be working exceptionally well. I'm a general contractor, and I know from my standpoint, obviously not with jobs the size of this, but I'm extremely impressed by the organization and just how smoothly that project, as complicated as it is, and in the area of town that it's located, to be going as smoothly.